The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. The Osomark Ocean by Kira Cowgill. Sable sits at the bow of the lead vessel, leaning against the railing while reviewing her calculations. Her journal is her most prized possession. The making of paper is an arduous task, which her family reminds her of any time they see her with the journal in hand. Each mark she makes is small and deliberate, and the journal itself she cares for tenderly. For years, Sable studied with Matthias as he tracked the course of the sun and moon and calculated their passage around the Osomark Ocean. Her family never would have made the journal for her if they didn't believe that one day she might take on the mantle of navigator herself. Any shoree can navigate the ocean by the time they can walk and talk. To them, using the celestial bodies in the sky to navigate is as simple as breathing. None, however, understand the cycles of Osomark, as well as Matthias. Matthias devoted his life to measuring the calendar and tracking the positions of the sun and moon. His decisions dictate which regions of Osomark the Shari will sail to and when. He must monitor the seasons and the weather so that they are always in the right place at the optimal time. Their powerful moon pulls at the ocean, creating extreme high and low tides. At low tide, the ocean recedes, revealing the source of the Shari's abundance, vast swaths of semi-aquatic forests. Gnarled trees with twisted roots barely anchoring them to the bits of land that are only visible at low tide. The forests rely on the Shari to cultivate them, and the Shari need wood and fruit from the trees to survive. Not to mention the countless other resources these ecosystems provide the community. Under Matthias's guidance, only the elderly of the Shari remember anything other than abundance and prosperity. They sail at high tide, moving from forest to forest as they require. During low tide, they tether themselves to the forest and work tirelessly. It is a delicate balance, and the Shari can never stay in the same place for too long. Though the tide is the cycle that dictates the rhythms of their lives, it is the night that they truly fear. At night, the Shari must never cross the deep ocean. They stay tethered to their forests through high tide, hides even the tallest trees from view. Matthias tells stories to the younger generations. Tales of twisted creatures from the deepest depths of Osomark that fear the light of the sun and only emerge when the moon is high. He claims that distant ancestors to the Shari lived on land, and that when they left their land to sail Osomark, it was the warmth of the sun that gave them the abilities they needed to survive the ocean. Now the Shari have eyes that can see through dark water and lungs that can hold their breath for 10 times as long as their ancestors. The digits of their hands and feet are webbed, and their bones can withstand a pressure that Matthias claims would have killed their land-bound ancestors. Many young Shuari doubt the truth of Matthias's words. Some even believe that they should sail across the deep ocean at night. Sable has never doubted him, though with her journal in her hands, a chilling fear creeps into Sable's chest. Her eyes drift along the sky, and again she confirms it. The path of the moon is set to intersect with the sun, but Matthias has them sailing across the deep ocean. For the first time, she begins to wonder if age has finally taken its toll on his mind, as well as his sight and hearing. Without any time left to question it, she turns and runs toward the back of the ship. Many questioning eyes follow her, but fear has its hand around her heart now, and she pays them no attention. Sable finds Matthias in his quarters, resting in his hammock, surrounded by a cloud of smoke. "Matthias," she begins urgently, before trailing off at the sight of him. He doesn't look her way, simply brings the pipe back to his lips for another breath. "Haven't you seen the quarter of the moon today? By my calculations, there's going to be an eclipse while we're stranded in the middle of the deep ocean. We're moving to intersect its path directly. We need to change our course." Her words spill out of her mouth in a breathless jumble, and for a moment, the only sound in the cabin is the creaking of his hammock and the pounding of her heart in her ears. "Don't be foolish. Your calculations are wrong," Matthias finally replies, not bothering to look at her. "But," she begins, but suddenly Matthias erupts. "I have spent my whole life navigating for our people. Don't think that you know more than me after a few years of study. If I say we are on the right course, then we are, and there is no reason for you to run around scaring the others because you made some foolish mistake." By the end, the old man is red-faced, sitting up as much as he can in his hammock, with his milky eyes fixed on Sable. She doesn't respond, simply stares at the ground, wishing his words would dispel the fear pulling in her gut. With nothing more to do, she gives him a small nod and departs silently. Sable returns to the bow of the ship, reviewing her notes again and again while watching the moon's path in the sky. She thinks about simply telling the captain of their vessel directly, but now Matthias's words have seeded doubt into her mind. If she's wrong, no one will ever listen to her again. Her future as navigator for her people will be lost. So she watches and waits. It isn't long before doubt resolves into certainty, but still she stays rooted to the group, paralyzed now by fear instead of uncertainty. Others begin to take notice. Even on the nearby vessels, Sable can make out the forms of people gathering on their decks and pointing into the sky. Matthias stays locked in his room, not answering the door for anyone, as every ship continues forward and the moon begins to cover the sun. Whispering becomes shouting, then fades completely to silence when darkness finally overtakes them. Every eye roams the ocean, searching the darkness for the monsters that have dictated the passage of their lives for as long as anyone can remember. The elderly murmur their prayers while the young question every story they've been told. Just as the eclipse reaches its peak, there is a shift in the currents around them. Light emerges from underneath the water, like a glowing eye beneath the ocean. Sable stands, gripping the railing at the bow of the ship and peering into the water. The beauty of it is enchanting, and she is so preoccupied watching the mysterious glow that she hardly notices as Matthias joins her at the bow. "I needed to know," he says, staring into the water himself. "My whole life we've avoided the deep ocean. My teacher taught me to fear it as did his before him. Now, at the end of my life, I simply needed to know." Sable gapes at him incredulously. "You'd risk us all for that?" she demands. "Every one of us could have died to fulfill your curiosity." "We didn't," he says, still avoiding her gaze. She almost continues, but her anger burns out as quickly as it began. She herself had spent her life questioning those stories. How could she know that she might not have done the same thing during her time as the navigator, as the younger generations begged her for change? "So what now?" she asks, feeling more like a helpless child than she had when she first begged Matthias to allow her to study with him. "We follow it," he says, directing her attention back to the water. The glowing eye that she had seen before had expanded. Before them now laid a path, one that pointed further into the deep ocean than they had ever sailed before. "Where do you think it goes?" "To land." The Last Ceaseless by Isabel Jewell. California, 2160. Theo's eyes shifted uneasily to the body beside him. "He's not dead," he tried to reassure himself. "Well, he's not alive either," his conscience retorted. Guilt ate at him like a zombie. But how was this his fault? He never asked to be a dead man's babysitter. Well, not dead. And he's 700-and-some years older than you. It was hard to imagine what it would be like to be frozen, asleep in a tank, even as Theo pressed his finger pads against the frosty glass. Not when the earth was burning, dry. How bad could a prison of sleep really be? Theo would have almost been willing to go back to the factories instead of spying for the extinguishers just to catch a night's worth of rest. But deep down, something kept nagging him, complaining like a toddler, "This isn't right." Centuries ago, maybe it would have been called inhumane, but nowadays, no one knew what human meant anyways. Theo watched, like a boy at a fish tank, for movement. A motion, a wince, a bubble of life, but none ever came. Immortal. Imagine that. But staring at the closed eyes and lifeless limbs of what everyone else said was a soulless beast, Theo didn't really envy him. "You're what?" Theo's eyes bulged wider, unable to believe what they were saying. "He's a destroyer, is what you all told me yesterday." Theo wiped sweat from his forehead. "Our job is to protect the world from him, and you're saying you want to go and jump on a sleeping rhino?" "I'm not saying I want to. I'm saying we're going to," the General Extinguisher, a.k.a. Locksmith, responded. "Orders came from above." "Why?" Theo threw his hands into the air. "What good is an out-of-control, revenge-bent super weatherman?" General Locksmith sighed, his patience always waning. "He's powerful. We need power if we are going to defeat the upholder. Has it not occurred to you that he could just kill us all and move on?" I paused, crossing my arms and looking at General Locksmith. the man who took away my everything and then saved me from nothing. You thought of that, right? My eyes were fixed on his annoyance, manifesting in his fidgeting, his sighing. You know, we die either way. No one knows what happened. But they say years ago, at the peak of human evolution, after the beginning of time, some humans were born special, with unnatural abilities, able to turn ice into water with a touch. Children who were capable of creating a flame with their fear. Women able to shake the earth with their screams. And men who could never die. They were called powers. Priests called them possessed demons. Kings killed them as other until the powers rebelled, banding together to create tribes, then kingdoms, and the powers finally took the place of the previous rulers until anyone without an ability was inferior. There were laws prohibiting intermarriage between a power and a powerless. Some say it was an era of magic, but people stopped seeing powers as humans. No one could see eye to eye, and thus the war for power began, waging for centuries, until gradually the powers, being painfully fewer in number than the powerless, began to become extinct. A truce was reached. Powers could have their own lands, communities, and even exercise their abilities, provided they lived on a block, a communal compound. Historians wrote that a ceaseless rose up and led a revolution, killing the monarch, destroying villages, creating a freezing cold that lasted until people begged him on their knees to provide sunshine, warmth. But they say he showed no mercy, killing more than 1,100,000 innocent powerless. Theo wondered if the sleeping stranger in front of him was truly capable of that. Theo's fingers traced designs in the fogged glass, then letters. "Hello, my name is Theo." Soon the body would be free. He'll be awake, alive. It finally felt right. Even if this stranger had tried to wipe out humanity, he was our prophesied demise. Of course, he didn't move. "Today's the day, bud." The extinguishers entered the room, so Theo began to leave. After all, Theo was intel, not a techie. Theo wasn't even good enough to be surveillance. But General Locksmith pulled him aside. Again. "Listen, Theo." His fingers dug into Theo's arm. "You're up." "What?" Theo answered, receiving glares from the extinguisher operators. "I have a new job for you." Theo waited. "When we wake him up, you are going to teach him our ways. You're going to be who he thinks of as his closest ally. You hear? The more time he has to regain his power, the more we lose our advantage." "They want a tool, not a person." "He's been dormant," the general locksmith explained, as if Theo were four. True, Theo had never seen a power before him. True, this stranger was the last ceaseless left. But the only reason Theo had ever been assigned to keep an eye on his tank of glass was as punishment for being out of order. Theo hadn't told them everything he'd seen at the factories, and they could tell. They didn't trust him. So why would they... Unless this is a suicide mission. They extracted the ceaseless from the tank, letting his body float to the surface. He looked young, with stark black hair that was tied back in a braid, a chiseled jaw, a good build, but a wounded arm. Overall, in one piece. They situated his head above the water, checking his vitals. After a green light was given, they pulled off the oxygen mask, letting the ceaseless breathe in the natural air. "Tell us when he wakes up," they told Theo. So Theo waited. Finally, his lips twitched. Theo jumped up from the floor to investigate incautiously. Then the ceaseless's dark brown eyes blinked open, and he began to look around. His gaze landed on Theo immediately. "You're awake," Theo exclaimed, hardly sure whether to be excited or terrified. "Elena," the now-awake Atmokinesis spoke. "Who?" Theo asked. "Where is Elena?" The entirely wet ceaseless staggered to his feet, freeing himself from the tank, turning the floor into a pool. "Tell me, where is she?" "I dunno," Theo stammered, entirely confused. "Who is she? What's she look like?" "She's my daughter." Theo's eyes widened. "Was." "I don't think you'll find her here," Theo tried to explain gently. "Then where will I find her?" His desperation made Theo even more guilty. "She's gone, man." "Gone?" The ceaseless looked like he'd been shot in the heart. "What do you mean?" You've been out of it for a while now." "Out of it?" The ceaseless looked entirely oblivious. "How could this man have destroyed us?" Theo shook his head. "You're in a new time, a new place. Before you were in England in 1362, give or take, but now you're in California or somewhere else, and it's, well, time's passed." "How much time?" "A lot." "How much?" 7 centuries? The ceaseless collapsed, sitting on the tiled ground. But then, everyone I have ever known is dead." Theo slowly nodded. For a moment, Theo watched the stranger's world lose all its meaning. "What's your name?" Theo tried. "Arthur." "Well, Arthur, I know this is a lot, but the Extinguisher Commander, a.k.a. Sledgehammer, strode in." "Slingshot," he addressed Theo. "You need to take precautions. Cuff him." Throwing Theo a pair of handcuffs, the extinguisher operators surrounded the room, waiting for action. Hesitating, Theo accepted the metal chains, taking a few steps closer. Too many memories of wearing the stiff metal devices flood Theo's mind, but he tried hard to push them aside. "Look, Arthur, we don't want to hurt you, but we're afraid of you. You're ceaseless, and we're, well, human. So can you come with me, and I'll explain as we go?" "You want me to be your captive?" The ceaseless eyed the ropes. "No, no," Theo explained, trying his damnedest to be diplomatic. "We want you to feel at home. Because if you don't help us, the world will kill us all," he thought. "What is all of this?" Arthur asked, pointing to the ceiling, then the tech equipment. "He's lived here for centuries and never seen it." "It's a machine," Theo tried to explain, "to help us do things. A tool." "I would like to go outside," Arthur insisted. "I'm not sure we're allowed, but we can try." Theo scanned his pass against the buzzer and walked down the halls with Arthur. "How did you get that gash? Theo pointed to Arthur's wounded arm. I was fighting someone. Arthur paused, as if trying to remember. Tell me about who you were, Theo asked. I was a mage, a nobleman, a father. Do you remember what you did? Theo was nervous to ask, but needed to know. The stories don't really show your good side. I remember being attacked for what I'd done. His eyes narrowed at the glass doors we went through. You tried to kill us all. Theo turned to face him. You wanted to murder, all powerless. You wouldn't know, was all Arthur whispered. Theo guided him to the fenced-off outdoor range of the extinguisher's base point. Concrete met the fake green grass with apprehension, but then there hadn't been real green plants growing in their natural habitat in a long time. The air was stiff, the heat exhausting. What happened? Arthur stared at the world as if he never knew it. A vast plain of factories could be seen in the horizon, a red sun above us, unrelenting. There's been no rain, Theo explained. Who are you? Arthur asked me as we walked indoors to the gardens where palm trees grew, flowers in brilliant fuchsia and tangerine, surrounded by large lime green leaves. He could say a spy, a traitor, powerless. I'm just Theo. I smiled. I'm from the slums, trying to get water to my people. What happened to all the water? Arthur inquired. I don't know, Theo shrugged. We've designed the world to revolve around us. We stopped the water from coming. We burned our own home. What about the ocean? Well, it's lower. Theo did not know how much science someone who was in an underwater coma would understand, but that was all anyone needed to know. A ping on Theo's phone made him glance at it. A text from General Locksmith. He didn't bother to look at it. The screensaver was a picture of Theo's father, before he passed away from heat stroke. Do you have a family? Arthur ventured with a quiet tone. Theo thought of his sisters, his little half-brother, his mother, his grandfather. No. Then we're the same, offered Arthur, his dark eyes oddly unsuspecting, his long braid mysterious. We're both alone. I'm supposed to befriend you when you don't even know me. You don't know how the story goes. We're only strangers trying to survive, he thought. Yeah, you're right, Theo smiled. But you know, we don't have to be. Theo pointed at the picture of his father. This is a photo. You can take it with your phone. Perplexity presented itself on the stranger's face. Like this. Theo gestured, showing him how to click a picture of the trickling water from the fountain, an item showing the extreme luxury of the wealthy. Try it. Arthur took the small phone in his large hands, clearly suspicious of it, but pressed the white circle, snapping a photo of the green underside of the palm tree's leaf. Then he accidentally hit the flip button, turning the camera into his own face. Staring at his reflection, Arthur blinked, shocked. Theo laughed. Okay, let me show you something. Grabbing the phone, Theo started to take a selfie. Darn, it was still set on a countdown timer. 5, 4, 3. Just then another text came in from the general. Slingshot, if you can't friend him, we have to kill him. I can't let that happen, he thinks, because he's the only thing who can free me from you. The shutter flashed. See? That's us, you and me, ceaseless. A smile crossed Arthur's face, and suddenly Theo felt a drop of rain. Untethered by A.B. Boatman. Danny felt untethered. It was like the drop of her stomach during a sudden fall, but without context. Was she falling? She had the sense that the space around her was somehow falling with her. Her understanding was fragmented, coming to her in pieces. Nausea, dizziness. For a brief instant, she imagined she could sense the space around her viscerally. Everything seemed to be coming to her through intense colors and sensations. It felt jarring to open her eyes, even the smallest amount. The air felt stale, recycled. She had anticipated fluorescent lights that would match the fabricated taste of the air. Instead, there was an inconsistent warmth in the way the light greeted her. It should have been comforting, but she felt uneasy. Her vision slowly focused on a seam in the ceiling, bolts holding together metal. It was unfamiliar. She tried to turn her head, but found it held in place. Something soft gently pressed against her forehead. She attempted to reach up, but realized her arms were also held at the wrists. In a sudden panic, she strained against them. She could feel her heart pounding. "Whoa, hey, take it easy." It was a familiar voice. Her eyes darted around, searching for the source. "Mom? Mommy?" She would have been embarrassed by how childlike she sounded under different circumstances. A familiar face came into view as she felt soft fingers on her cheek. "Yes, I'm here. Just breathe." She calmed at the sound of her mother's voice, incrementally and automatically. "I'm going to take the straps off, but I need you to relax." "What's going on? Where?" She exhaled suddenly, needing to release the pressure of overwhelm. "Where are we?" There was silence as her mother worked on her head and arm straps. There was a smile on her gently lined face, but Danny could see the strain there as well. She had a tightness around her mouth. Her eyes, generally full of brightness and comfort, were worried. They were also clearly working at avoiding Danny. She repeated, "Where are we, Mom?" Her arms were free, and her mother had moved towards her legs. As she strained to watch the process, she felt a sudden lack of something that startled her. Despite the situation, she stopped and stared at her hands. They stayed where they were, floating there above the surface she was laying on, with no effort on Danny's part. "We left." She looked out of the thick glass in awe of the sheer number of stars littered across the sky. "You knew how I felt. You knew I wanted to stay." Space travel was not uncommon, especially in the last 10 years of doomers boomers fleeing Earth's problems. But it was expensive, uncomfortable, and crowded. Despite finding intrigue in the concept, she never wanted to go. Feared it, was repulsed by the idea of leaving the earth, its trees, sky, snow, and sand, and all the people she loved. She was livid, shaking with a combination of shock and fury, burning red. This all while still adjusting to the lack of gravity and the disbelief of being where she was disorienting. Again, for an instant, she had the sensation that her emotion, her consciousness, was expanding out of her body. She could sense the space that her mother took up next to her body heat and anxiety crackling, her own energy bouncing off the thick sheets of metal that contained the air, keeping them alive. Even the electricity running through the wires in the hull left an impression on her for that moment. Finally, her mother spoke. "We couldn't stay." "Couldn't? I never wanted to spend my life floating in a tin can in space. I'm not a child. You can't do this." She wished that for once she was able to yell, to raise her voice to match the intensity she felt inside. If there was a time to express it, this would be it. "Danny, I understand why you're upset." Her voice was quiet. "This makes no sense. You always called the Doomer Boomers dramatic. Things were improving. Plastics were down, the shields were up and working for the flares. Even in my lifetime, things got better. I mean, you know, things were improving. Those people running crammed in those ships, just going out. There's nowhere to go. It's an idea sold by greedy corps. What kind of life?" She stopped. It occurred to her then that she was on a spaceship. "How are we here?" Her voice was low, gesturing to her surroundings. Her mother seemed thrown by her sudden shift in subject. What do you mean?" "I mean, I've seen the ships that we could afford a spot on. They were a few steps up from the Apollos, and from what I've heard, don't fly until fully booked. I don't see huddled masses. And there's some tech I've never seen. Expensive, I assume. How are we here?" "An old friend." She took small puffs from the pouch. The mush was surprisingly flavorful, though the texture would get old fast. At the moment, it was a helpful distraction. She needed to eat. Her mother told her as much before leaving her alone in the kitchen. She was feeling shaky and restless, like she was coming out of her skin. The strange flashes of feeling out of her body were wearing on her already fraught emotional state. She assumed it was a result of whatever her mother drugged her with, or being in space. She finished her pouch as she stared at the wall, trying to organize her thoughts and experiences into a unified whole that made sense. She could sense conclusions on the edge of her mind that she was trying to avoid, something she was not quite ready to incorporate, because she was not quite sure what it meant. She heard voices down the hall. Before she knew what she was doing, she was gently pushing herself off the wall and floating towards the sounds. The passage was narrow, presumably to prevent anyone from losing control as they went careening through the small space. As she neared the first doorway, the voices became more discernible. "Her, what if I can't say it right? I want her to understand." A recognizable feminine voice answered, not quite robotic, but tinny, as if contained in a metal box. "As stated previously, the connection you have will likely aid in creating a more desirable emotional response, which will make the process smoother for everyone." There was a pause, and then she heard her mother release a sob in a sudden muffled burst. Danny fought the urge to go to her, a painful blue bubble in her chest, but she was finally getting some answers. There were sounds of slow breathing as her mother calmed herself. "She's so young," it was said so softly, and Danny thought her mother had said it to herself until she heard the reply. "Is she not fully matured by the standards of your society? We realized 30 was somewhat arbitrary, but our preliminary findings suggested that this was the age of a fully mature adult." "Yes, yes, but..." She could hear exasperation in her mother's voice. "She is mature, but to me, there is still so much for her to see and do. On Earth, I mean. You never want to see your child die." Her stomach lurched, and she felt her skin tingle, a pale pink, spiny feeling. She could hear her pulse in her ears. "She will not die. We have explained that. I know..." There was silence. Danny's hands were shaking as she allowed herself to float toward the door automatically. What is this? What is happening? Her mother's red-rimmed wide eyes stared at her. It created a swirl of conflicting emotions, glowing coal-like resentment and slowly simmering guilt, deep purple. It was becoming difficult to process at all. She could feel neurotransmitters and blood physically working through her body, in her shoulder blades and down to her hands, welling up in her throat. Suddenly the warm lights brightened and flickered in the room. They both looked up to watch, temporarily distracted. The flickering ceased after a moment, and she shifted her attention back to her mother and the source of the other voice. It was a simple EV unit. Probably one of the earliest models. It was the type that had the basic conversational AI programs on it. Nothing she would expect to be able to have the conversation she just heard. It appeared to be in sleep mode. Her mother was still watching her, tears filling from her eyes but not falling. Danny, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. For what? Tell me what is going on. Why are we on this ship? The walls vibrated around her in jade ripples. Her mother also glanced around, almost as if the vibrations were not just in Danny's head. This ship is not aimless. Okay, where are we going? You needed space. We'll need more than a regular person. Human. I am human. Yes, you are. But you are also something more. This is ridiculous. Colorless and clear, without substance. Her mother's face was serious as she continued, looking as if she was forcing herself to power through her next words. We thought you weren't going to happen for us. Me and your father. It had been 5 years of trying, and we were tired. And then they came and offered help, and there you were. Her eyes were misty as she spoke, and she managed a small, sad smile towards Danny. Danny felt a flood of warm forest green in her chest. As she listened, she struggled to piece the jagged shards of information together. So, I'm adopted? She couldn't believe that. She looked just like her mother. She heard it all the time. No, not really. You are fully, biologically, of me and your father, but there's more. It's how they... She struggled for words, then looked to the EV with desperation. Please. The unit extended its head as it came out of the sleep state, startling Danny, who had almost forgotten it was there and working, allowing it to blend into the surroundings as they were talking. Hello, Danielle. Hi. She felt dazed. She was talking to an EV, a commercial, ubiquitous piece of tech. It shouldn't be able to do much more than give her takeout options, let her know what the weather is, or bring her extra toilet paper. You are human, as your mother stated. You are also a developing part of us. I don't understand. Who is us? We do not have a name for ourselves in terms you can comprehend from your own understanding of the universe. We are a species that exists in multiple dimensions. Existing in this dimension as an individual requires a body, preferably organic. In our first stage of life, we are incubated as the consciousness of a biological organism. You are nearing the end of this stage and are ready to move to the next stage in the process. What process? Swirling gray dread. Humans are different than we expected. Your connection to others of your species and the emotional experiences that result interact powerfully with our energies, The effects are bringing forth the critical points sooner than expected. Time is limited. There was a rush just below her skin. White rapids, more intensely this time, as the Evie's words sunk in. "That is what you are feeling, love." It was her mother speaking again. "What do you mean?" She heard the defensiveness in her own voice. "I see it, love. You feel it." "I still don't understand." Again, the lights dimmed and came back on in rapid succession. It was getting harder to ignore. Evie spoke again. "You are prepared to move to the next phase. It is important for you to be in the right place."
"Where?"
Silence. Danny asked again, "Where are we going?"
"It's why we had to leave, love."
She felt uneasy. It simmered in her stomach, an orange, sickly fizzing. She was becoming more aware of it, and she could feel the air doing the same in ripples around her.
"What is happening to me?"
Evie spoke again. "It will begin soon."
"What does that mean? What is the next phase?"
"It is the end of the organic structure of your body. It is a new way to be in the universe."
She glanced at her mother and was weighed down suddenly by an inky black. She vaguely noticed her sweater changing color.
"Mom, why are you crying?"
"Please leave us, Evie."
"The time is of supreme."
"I know. Just give us time. I will take care of her."
"Very well. It is in your hands." Danny was in shock. She did not fully comprehend what they were saying, but she knew the ominous feeling she had was appropriate as she watched the Evie use small puffs of compressed air to maneuver itself out of the room. Her mother was in front of her, her hand gently cupping Danny's face.
"Mom, you are going to be okay, love."
"No, I'm not. I heard you talking. I'm going to die, aren't I?"
"Not really. You will go on. You will remember this life. It will just be different."
"But my body? It will die. And all my friends at home? I'll never see them again. Or you. Why couldn't I stay there?"
She knew she sounded childish again, but she didn't care.
"You don't know what you will see again. I don't know how it works. I just know we had to be away from the earth so that..."
She trailed off and looked down for a moment before continuing.
"You won't cease to exist, and that makes me happy, because I couldn't stand to be here if that was the case. But it's going to be big and destructive. They told me that you won't feel a thing, but if we had stayed on Earth, it would have been deadly for every living thing. And I knew you wouldn't want that."
The panic was back, white hot and breathtakingly bright. Danny could feel tears staining her cheeks. Her skin felt as if it were vibrating with a sharp, molten heat. Fear. She focused on her mother's voice, her face. She could smell the hint of her perfume, the same one she had worn for as long as Danny could remember. It was comforting. Made her feel almost as if her feet were on the ground.
"I remember when you were born. You were wrinkly and red. I can picture your spastic little limbs. I can feel the frustration of trying to get you to stop crying. The annoyance of dealing with your defiance at bedtimes when you were 3. The challenge of keeping a straight face when you were 5 and being hilarious while I was trying to discipline you. I remember the first time you told me you loved me and you actually knew, more or less, what it meant. I remember seeing you fall in love with a book, getting obsessed with a band, and rolling your eyes with pure annoyance, directed squarely at me. I've never loved anything as fully as I have loved you. I'm scared, too, because I've been able to witness your life, and I don't know what is going to happen to you, but I know it's more than I could fathom. And still, you are giving them something they've never experienced. They have never known the pain and joy and pure ache of loving someone the way I loved you, the way you loved me. Wherever you go, you will have that memory. And that has to be enough for me, that I could give you that and that you could share it with a whole species. The deep violet pressure in her chest expanded and contracted with heaving breaths. She had not realized what had happened, but she was gripping her mother's hands tightly. She could sense a rumbling beginning in her stomach and rolling out through her limbs. Her mother's eyes glanced down at where their hands met with wonder and slight fear. "Don't be afraid. They told me it would be quick." Frozen. "Mom, what are you doing? You said it would be destructive. You aren't supposed to be here." Even as Danny looked around to find a way to get her mother out, her mother let out a sigh of laughter. "My home is underwater and my husband is gone. I love my life, but the time I have left is not worth letting you do this on your own. Because I needed you to take this with you. I need you to always carry the knowledge that you were loved. And what that looks like in action, it feels important for more than just us." "Mom, no, I'm not afraid of death, Danny. The only thing I fear is..." A flash shattered the moment into pieces. There were colors she'd never seen as she felt no more, and somehow everything. Everything was in pieces around the point she had existed within. She sensed it, yet had no attachment to it. She felt, instead, a melding with something new, an impression of newness and belonging. She was flooded with understanding of new things fit together, how they functioned. It would have been overwhelming, running through her previous biology, but now it just was. She also knew, sensed deeply, the shift her previous experience had caused to this collective she was now a part of. She could feel curiosity from outside the individual aspect of her being. It was difficult to grasp. It was a warmth and an anchor, a tether to something so different, yet so much the same as oneself. And as the sensation arose, she recognized a familiar essence. "Mom,"